We are on Daf Lamed Dalet Amud Aleph. And we had completed the sugya mostly, I think had completed the sugya of vessels that had contained non-Jewish wine. And I was finally had my hand forced by Aaron, and I once we finished the sugya, we had to talk about, you know, sherry casks and blended whiskey. So now we're back to finishing the sugya. We have to deal a little bit more with byproducts of wine, and then we get to cheese, which is a very interesting topic in many, many ways. So we are on Daf Lamed Dalet Amud Aleph, right where the lines get wide, Tanu Rabbanan. So the Gemara quotes a braisa, Tanu Rabbanan, Hachartzanim v'hazagim shel oved kochavim, lachim asurim yiveshim mutarim. Now, this actually was a braisa related to the Mishnah. If you turn back to the Mishnah for one moment, we have to do this frequently, it's a Mishnah with many topics here. Unfortunately, for some reason, the editors of the Gemara, when they put the Mishnah in, chose not to break it up and, you know, sort of have smaller units. They made a very big Mishnah, not the whole Perek. So it take a while and you forget what the Mishnah said. So if you look in the Mishnah, and here would have been the logical split. Cause
where's the Mishnah?
On Chav Tes Amud Beis.
Is there generally a reason for that, Rabbi, or...?
It's kind of random. In other words, if you do Maseches Sanhedrin, for example, in the first chapter, they put the entire Mishnah, the first Amud and on to the second, is all Mishnah, and there's no Mishnah in the rest of the Perek, and the Perek is about 14 Dapim. You find this in the latter Prakim of Maseches Sota. Once upon a time, there might have been Mishnayos in the Gemara, but that would be a time immemorial before we even know. By the time you get to the medieval manuscripts, for the most part, with one notable exception, where the Mishnah is actually written in not in the margin, but it's kind of like a, not just like a Rashi, but it's kind of written in a different font, a different script, and it's written kind of on the inner margins of the page, and much bigger. But pretty much all of the Gemara manuscripts that we have, there is no Mishnah in them. All you have are fragments, citations of parts of the Mishnah, and it's cited piece by piece as it's needed, but you could not reconstruct the entire Mishnah from such manuscripts. At some point, I don't know if there are later manuscripts or in the printed edition, the printers had to put in the Mishnah. So in some cases, they decided, well, let's break down the Mishnah. I'm not going to stick all the Mishnahs to the beginning of the Perek. Instead, we'll do piece by piece, you know, each Mishnah and a couple of lot, and so on and so forth. And sometimes, I'm not sure if they were lazy, they had no time, whatever it was, they took the entire Mishnah and they stuck it in one place, and then you had the whole Perek. So I don't know why. If you're interested, there's a book, I think the author's name is Marvin Heller. He's I don't mean an amateur scholar in a negative sense, but is sort of a layman scholar, and he wrote a book on the printing of the Talmud. It's quite a hefty volume. So I have it, but I haven't had the chance to read it, as with many other books on my shelf. But that's probably the place to look. I suspect he would talk about it. There's also something called the person who did the Dikduke Sofrim. The Dikduke Sofrim is this work on most of Shas, everything but Seder Nashim, of textual variants. It was done by Rav Rabinowitz in the second part of the 19th century. It was originally printed in a bunch of small little volumes, you know, Masechta or a couple Masechtas at a time, and it's been reprinted in two very big, you know, Shulchan Aruch size volumes. So he has, I think it's printed there, but they printed it separately because the print is impossible to read, called Ma'amar al Hadpasat HaTalmud, I think it's called. So he has also a lengthy discussion. So I suspect that's what you would find the answer.
That printing the Talmud, that's the volume that they gave out one year at the Wayu Hanukkah dinner. Is it the same one?
I think not. I think I remember when they had the thing at the Wayu Museum. There was a different volume, which is a collection of essays. Chaim Soloveitchik had an essay, Yaakov had an essay. I think that's the volume they gave out. That's what I believe. This is a separate volume. Okay, so anyway, so the Mishnah says that Chartzan, the first two dots in the two dots in the middle of the Mishnah, Chavtesam Adays, HaChartzanim VaHazagim Shel Ovdei Kochavim Asurim VeYisuron Yisur Hana'ah. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says that you have chartzanim and zagim of a goy. Now, what are chartzanim and zagim? So, strangely enough, the language of the Mishnah is an interesting choice. What's that?
Nazir.
So it's taken from the Pasuk in Nazir. Interestingly enough, in the Pasuk in Nazir, there's a machlokes hatanaim in the Mishnah in Nazir, what is a chartzan and what is a zag? So the expression is mechartzanim v'ad zag lo yochel. So one of those two things is the skin of the grape, and the other part is the stuff inside with the seeds. I think that the preference that Tosfos has on Lamed Hey Amud Aleph here, and probably the pshat, is the chartzanim are the stuff inside, and the zag is the outside. Because the zag is only one, but the chartzanim are plural. Mm-hmm. But whichever it is, what it means here is that the non-Jews stomped on the grapes. Now, the concern seems to be that once they step on the grapes and the wine comes into formation, this may not be correct, but the simple understanding is that once they do that, there's yayin inside the grapes, which is yayin nesach. In other words, they haven't squeezed everything out and they've come in contact with it, and therefore there's a problem with the chartzanim and the zag, just like there's a problem with the yayin.
It hasn't fermented yet.
For the purposes of stam yayinam and yayin nesach, there's no need for fermentation, right? Grape juice is certainly not fermented, but we assume that it has the same requirements of hashkacha as would the yayin, right? even though that yayin, this might be for Shabbos Shuvah, Shabbos Hagadol, but yayin, grape juice, what I mean is unfermented liquids squeezed out of grapes, let me formulate it carefully that way, they may not be kosher to bring on the Mizbeach. I don't know of an explicit source. And there are explicit sources, but it's not. I don't remember what the origin is. The Mishnah in Avios says that 40-day wine was used on the Mizbeach. It implies that that's the minimum amount of aging that you need. But despite the fact that grape juice, freshly squeezed grape juice, may not be Roy LaMizbeach, the assumption is that since it will become Roy LaMizbeach, it is subject to the Gzeira of Yayin Nesach and Stam Yenam. Mm-hmm. Right? As opposed to if you boil, if you cook it, if it's mavushal, once you mavashal it and it's rendered invalid for the mizbeach, and apparently non-Jews wouldn't libate it either to their idols, so then it's not a problem.
So they're adding chemicals that don't allow it to ferment. You know, there's in the early stages of being grape juice, not boiling, but chemically arresting.
Are you asking me if they do such a thing?
Well, that is what that is what it's done. No, don't they add preservatives to the grape juice so that it can't release?
Well, my impression is that that's not what prevents the fermentation is the boiling. That's the impression. The boiling and then the bottom and the sealing. So maybe they add some preservative. I don't know if they do or not. But even there, it's not entirely clear. It might still have the din, even though, I mean, it's hard to know, even though it might not be, in other words, the fact that it's not suitable for the Mizbeach at that stage without, if you didn't boil the grape juice, if the grape juice were left unboiled, it might very well be that it's still subject to the prohibition of Stam Yenam and Yai Nesach. I don't know. So the Mishnah says that Rabbi Meir holds that chartzanim and zagim, you're not allowed to. They're asur and you can't get hanah. V'chachamim omrim lachin asurin. If the chartzanim and zag are still moist, then they're prohibited. Yeveshin are mutarim. Once they're totally dried out, the Gemara will talk about what dried out means. So then they are permitted. So the Gemara here just quoted. Now let's come back to Lamed Amud Aleph. So again, the Braisa here cited what was the opinion of the Chachamim. Tanu Rabbanan Achartzanim Azagim Sheol Dekachavim Lachem Asur Yeveshim Mutarim. Now the Gemara says, Hayninhu Lachem V'Hayninhu Yeveshim. What are considered moist and what's considered dry? How do you define that? Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel Lachem Kol Yud Beis Chodesh Yeveshim Lachar Yud Beis Chodesh. He says that if the chartzanim and the zag were sitting around for 12 months, they've dried out and they've been left to dry for 12 months, that's called dry. Less than 12 months, that's called moist. Now, this Gemara, we have to deal with this in first, but this is now going to lead us into the second step of when does 12 months solve all sorts of problems when it comes to yayin and other kinds of things. We'll come back to that in a moment. But in the meantime, The Gemara assumes that 12 months is the criteria. The question would be the following. What if someone decided to artificially dry them out? What if you decide to kind of, I don't know, bake them, put them under heat, and so on? So apparently in Ashkenaz, there was a practice of taking the leftovers of the wine. Again, you remember, you press the wine and you're left with all this stuff. What are you going to do with this stuff? So they would take it, they would dry it out, and then would use it as a catalyst, as yeast for bread. So if you look in the bottom Tosfos on the page, the Gemara. Well, we'll have to read a little further in the Gemara, but it's really on the very same thing. Let's just read a couple of lines on. Firstly, Amar Rav Itmar, Amar Rabba Bar Chana Rabbi Yochanan, Kishehin Asurin, Asurin Afilu Bano, Kishem Mutar, Mutar Afilu Bachila. Notice that Rabbi Meir said, Isurin, Asurin Ve Isurin Isurhana. Rabbi Meir in the Mishnah says, without distinguishing between Lach and Yavish, before or after 12 months, Rabbi Meir says that before 12 months, the Meir says that it's Asur and it's Asur Bano, period, before and after 12 months. The Chachamim say no. They say that if it's still moist, then it's Asr. The Gemara says here, Rabbi Yochanan says, Asr Bahana. And once it's dried out, not only is it Mutar Bahana, it's even Mutar to eat it. That's what the Mishnah said. Now, if you stop and think for a moment, going back to the topic of the last few weeks, the question is, why should it be permissible? Why should it be permissible to consume this even after it's dried out? After all, aren't you getting benefit on some level from the flavor of the yayin? Like, that's why you're doing this. Whatever you're going to do with this dried out, with these dried out chartzanim and zagim, so isn't there a problem of getting some benefit from the yayin? And I think that on the simple level, the answer might be sort of the same thing that we said for the last few weeks, which is the prohibition of getting hana from yayin is limited to situations where it's really considered tam of yayin. Right. And the assumption is that once you've allowed these things to age, to dry out for 12 months, whatever flavor, you might say you're getting grape flavor, but you're not getting wine flavor. And if it's not wine, then it's not a problem. Right? It's different than all other prohibitions. All of the prohibitions, when the substance is fundamentally prohibited, once it's prohibited, if you can taste it absorbed in something else, if it has an impact, a discernible impact, you can't consume it. But here it might be that it loses whatever you get out of it after 12 months, because you are choosing to eat it, to use it in some fashion, whatever you get out of it, and by the way, the more likely thing, what would someone have done with this once it was fully dried out? What's the most likely usage?
Fertilizer. Food.
Something.
Fertilizer.
You could like sprinkle it on your food, maybe.
So
grind it up.
So I would assume, we'll see, Rabbi Natan talks about this a little bit, one of the possibilities is to make what we call temed, which is to put the stuff, soak it in water, and guess what you get?
Wine.
You get wine. You get something flavored, a little bit of wine. So that's what I would have assumed would have been one of the lot. It's not clear that the only use for this, but in that case, you would think that it should be osir. So apparently, we would say that that's not called tam yayin. Once it gets beyond a certain point, it might be the tam of grapes and the substances contained there within, but it's not considered yayin. And if it's not considered yayin, it's not our problem.
This is different from raisins.
What's that?
Raisins. Raisins.
Raisins.
Dried out grapes?
Well, no, raisins wouldn't be a problem generally because grapes are not a problem. Right, so, grapes of non-Jews are not a problem. It's only when they squeeze it out. But once you squeeze out the grapes, I don't think you make raisins out of it. Right, you've given out most, you've taken out most of the flavor, right? Raisins are just grapes that are dried up. But not, you're not left with a pile of raisins once you squeeze the, raisins in waiting once you have pressed all the grapes.
After 12 months, it's possible that the chemical and physical properties change. It's not the same thing that it was original, because it's dried out. It's just the
If anything, it hasn't changed. Right? The drying out, the absence of water, or the absence of water means that whatever's there is going to stay as it is.
You can reconstitute.
Right. That's what I would think. Okay. So anyway, so the Gemara now says, Amar Rabbi, in the same vein, Amar Rabbi Zvid, second to last line, Hay Durdaya de Chamra, de Aramai. Durdaya, Rashi says, are shmarim. It's the lees or the dregs that sort of settle out of the wine. Basar treser yarche shata shari. After 12 months, they're permitted as well. So the Gemara, so Tosos, look at the bottom Tosos. Tosos says the following. Peirush shmarim shel ovdei kochavim. The same interpretation as Rashi. Harav Rabbeinu Ephraim, probably Ephraim of Regensburg, Hoya Omer, ki misvara, shmarim shenisyab shubatanur, Moil lohem kimo hamtana diyud beis chodesh. If you take shmarim, you take the lees, and you dry them out in the oven, it's the same thing as keeping in 12 months. You just speed up the process. Umitokach, because of that, Hitir Pashel of the Kochavim Shenechmatz Bishimre Yahin Shenesiab Shubitaner. Apparently, the non-Jews would use these dried out lees. They would use that as a candle that apparently worked for his yeast. And his argument was that since the Shemarim themselves were permitted, because they had been dried out, even though they hadn't been left for 12 months, so he said that that's permitted. Okay. Rabbeinu Tam hikpid alav. Rabbeinu Tam was not very happy about this. Rabbeinu Tam said, what are you talking about? The Omar, ki ma shematir ha-talmud durdaya la'achar yud beis chodesh, is only la'achar shenitmidu b'mayim, kemosher regilam ha'amlasos. He says, that's not, you got it all wrong. He says, when we say that the Shemarim are permitted, that's only if, before you dry them out, you make temed from them. And what making temed means, in the Gemara's description, is that you soak them in water, which extracts flavor of the wine from the lees. Once you've done that and you've extracted as much as you can, and then you dry, and then you drain off the water, you dry out the dregs and the lees, and then after 12 months it's permitted, or maybe if you dried it out in the oven, but not before you've gone through that second stage of removing the flavor of the wine. He says, what you do with the dregs of the wine is you put in three portions of water, and what you get out is just four portions of liquid. Why? Because you're extracting the wine that was absorbed in these dregs. Perak elu ovrin gabe temed kamar haba ravka haba portzani. So the Gemara comments, makes a distinction between two substances there, and Rabbeinu Tam explains that temed she'osim mishmarim korin ravaka. He says the when you make temed, again, I don't know if you want to call this wine drink, when you make it from shmarim, it's called ravaka, ki ha'shem asak she'mesimin bo ha'shmarim letzamdan nikrakein, kedamrinan ravke da'aramoi. He said, apparently there was a name of a certain type of a vessel, and you made shmarim in it, and that's why the name of this kind of wine was called ravka. V'kodem she'nismedu ha'shmarim, before you make temed out of the shmarim, nikram b'lashon ha'talmud shmarim. That's what they're called. And he quotes a Gemara by Metzia that to demonstrate that. V'achar, ki'ahi de'perek ha'mafki de'kamar gufa v'ushmaraya. V'achar shenismendu, once you make teben out of it, nikru durdaya. That's when you get the term durdaya, and that's what the Gemara is talking about here. But the Gemara is not talking about actual shmarim. Shmarim haven't had the wine extracted from them yet. V'ahanu mayri ha'chalatiran la'achar yudbeis chadashim. Only here does the Gemara say it's mutter after 12 months. The ika tarti l'tevusa, because you have two things going for you. One, shekvar nisbatel tamam b'mayim. One is that you extracted the wine flavor in the temed process. And number two, v'gam avar aleihem yud beis chodesh. And you've also waited 12 months. And Rabbeinu Tam claims v'chein portzani nami deshari le'achar yud beis chodesh. The Gemara is going to use the word later, portzani. But portzani is chartzani menzag. It's the same thing. I don't know why the Gemara repeats itself, but the previous Tosis points out that the targum of mechartzanim and the adzag is miportzanin. So portzani are chartzanim, which are the pulp and the seeds inside the grape. So Rabbeinu Tam says, v'chein portzani nami, the Gemara on the next, right on top of the next page, is going to say, d'shari l'achar yud beis chodesh, heim ha'chartzanim l'achar shenismedu. You can only use the chartzanim if they've been dried out after 12 months, if you made temen out of them first. Aval shmarim shelo nismedu, shmarim and presumably portzani, chartzanim, which didn't have the wine extracted, ein shum moel davar moel latiran. Nothing helps to permit them. You can make them as dry as the desert. Doesn't change anything. And now the next step, you have to ask the question, okay, so you shouldn't have used this as yeast, but why can you taste the yeast in the bread? No. The answer should be no. It's less than shishim, you can't taste it. So Rabbeinu Tam says, Va'isa shenechmitza nishenischamza behen kodem timudam le'olam asura. So anything, any bread that was made before you made them temed out of them is going to be asur. Oh, besochir beis chodesh achar av la'achar timudam asurim. Doesn't matter whether or not you use these leaves within 12 months after you made temed, or after 12 months but you didn't make temed first with them. If you haven't gone through a double stage of removing the flavor of the wine, number one, making temed, and number two, drying them out, he says the dough that the bread that's made from them is absolutely asur. Va'afilu be'elef lo batil. Even if you have 1,000 times the amount of the dough as the yeast, it's still all asur. Kevan de letaima ovid. Why? Because yeast is meant to flavor things. Now here, we're going to have more of a discussion about this, but it doesn't mean tam in the sense of you can taste the yeast. It means tam in the sense that the impact on the flavor of the food is recognizable. And while you can't actually taste the yeast, bread which has yeast in it and has risen because of the yeast tastes very different than bread that doesn't have yeast in it. That's the difference between bread and matzah. So, what's that?
Are we dealing with hana'ah?
So the answer is yes. Yes, so because once you say that the yeast is asur b'hana'ah and it's not batel, presumably the bread is asur b'hana'ah.
Right, so if you're using this for animal feed or you're using it as a tannin for curing leather, that's also asur.
That's right.
So the taste quality, the flavor quality is totally irrelevant.
Correct. It's the impact upon the set. In other words, what Rabbi Natan is really talking about here is what's called davar hama'amid. Something, in other words, the idea of bittul is that you can't recognize the presence of the isser. Normally, the way it's like it doesn't exist anymore. A piece of chazir gets mixed into a big vat of meat. You can't taste it. So for all intents and purposes, it doesn't exist anymore. But if I take a tiny amount of yeast, but I put it into a dough, and now all of a sudden the dough rises, and it wouldn't have risen, assuming in some cases it wouldn't have risen without the yeast, so now I can see the yeast. I mean, I can't see it physically. I can't taste it in the classic sense, but I see the impact of the yeast. It's odenu ba'olam. It really still exists in the world, and that's why there's no bittul. It happens to be that lack of bittul is only midrabbanon. Even if one assumes that we say tam ki'ikar is deraisa, that if you can taste the flavor, even though it's a very small minority, that the food is asur min haTorah, so davar hamami pretty much everybody assumes is not batel, only midrabbanon. But nonetheless, it's not batel.
Is there an analogy here, koshering these zagin, like koshering meat? Because first you're soaking it, and then you have the blood.
So I'm pretty sure that no one would say that if you took meat and you dried it out completely and then you reconstituted it with water or anything, I don't think anybody would say that that's mutter. I think not, but you never know,
gelatin,
right?
No, I meant in terms of ridding it of its blood, whether it's the blood of the grape. I'm talking about the blood part. Because
yes.
You're trying to get the blood out of the meat. You're getting the blood of the grape out of the grape.
Yeah, I don't know, but nobody. I don't think it's the same thing.
Trying, pushing.
It seems like Rabbeinu Tam is being machmir here.
Yes, very
and
much.
This is quite surprising, considering in other parts of Shas, why here is Rabbeinu Tam being so machmir when in such cases where you're talking about something a food that has, mm-hmm. you know, where it could be a loss to his constituency. Where he might have tried to be makil so that people wouldn't lose, you know, have to do all these
right.
things.
So it's impossible probably to know, because if I were a historian writing a paper about this, I would be starting with this as one of my data points. I'd be coming in the opposite direction. In other words, you see that this wasn't such a great economic loss. And the truth is what Rabbeinu Tam is describing here is buying Gentile baked bread. Right? In other words, so bake your own bread. I suspect, no, but that's not enough. There has to be another piece to this. And the other piece to this, I think, is the following. I think it sounds to me like this was not widespread minhag. It sounds like Ephraim, I don't know if Rabbeinu Ephraim of Regensburg was the one who first permitted it. It may have been people were doing it, and he sort of gave his hechsher to it, in effect. But I suspect that this was not widespread minhag. The approach of the Balei HaTosfos is to, you know, go to the mat defending practices that seem to advance the Gemara when already the minhag is sufficiently widespread.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be working backwards. I would say that you see that the minhag really wasn't so widespread. It was very local, and Rabbeinu Tam responded very strongly against it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas had this been so widespread in, you know, France and Germany,
yes.
Rabbeinu Tam would have said the same thing as Rabbeinu Ephraim. That would be my guess. And in fact, we're not
talking about a wine processed by a non-Jew.
No, correct. But they were relying.
Rabbeinu Tam is worried about wine processed by a Jew. So wine processed by a Jew, you can sell to a non-Jew. Mm-hmm. But wine processed by a non-Jew, he doesn't want the competition. So he says,
no, I don't think, I'll tell you, I don't think that's the case. Jews weren't producing wine for the most part. In other words, it was not big Jewish business. Jews were not. Jews probably produced wine only. What's that?
Rashi.
So that's an urban legend. Rashi was busy. This came from Professor Agus. You know, during the Crusades, the Torah survived because Rashi was busy tending his vineyards in northern France. Except for Rashi was not busy tending his vineyards in northern France because Rashi was not a vintner, because Jews, for the most part, were not involved in viticulture. And the region in which Rashi lived, apparently Dr. Soloveitchik has visited and said, it's not suitable for viticulture. And Professor Agus only said that because there was one tshuva of Rashi, and tshuva's Rashi, where Leah, a woman named Leah, you know, asked the Mishaila, but how do you tax vineyards? Because normally people were used to taxing commerce, but here you had really capital, whatever it was, you had the principle in how do you tax. And Rashi said whatever he said, and the truth is, that proves, in fact, that Jews were not involved in viticulture for the most part, because if they had, everybody would have known how you tax it, what the rules were, and there would have been no need to ask Rashi. And Professor Agus assumed, of course, Leah was Rashi's mother, because we know that because, I don't know, and therefore Rashi was tending his vineyards, but he wasn't. And so I don't think it was economic competition. Where you see the very makil about Stam Yenam is not even about Jewish wine. This is, we saw a little bit of this in the last couple of weeks. It came up sort of in the background last week, is that in Ashkenaz, they were very lenient about at least getting hana from Stam Yenam. They engaged in business. They would buy and sell, and that was very problematic, because the simple reading of the Gemara, we're going to see later in the Masechta, is that Stam Yenam is aser b'hana. I mean, we've already sort of passed it. Even though we know they're not libating it, the Gzeira applies both to drinking it and to getting hana. So I don't think it was economic competition from the Gentile wine. Marshall?
Back to the Gemara for a second.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I find it very surprising that the response to B'hayinin Hu Yaveishim is actually good Bet Chodesh.
Yes.
Because many of the times a sentence like that would actually finish with a physical standard about Naru V'Achila, or it crumbles, or this and that. And first of all, in a desert culture, it probably takes about 5 days out in the desert sun for something to become vegetated and dry.
Okay.
It certainly doesn't take 12 months. I mean, you couldn't have dried anything if it took 12 months out of the desert to dry it. And so, I guess two questions. One, the conceptual one, which is, why do they reach for a kind of a temporal paradigm to decide when something is dry or not, as opposed to a physical paradigm, which usually applies to the status of food? And the second is, Yud Bei Chodesh just seems bizarre and way off any connection to reality.
So, firstly, I, as regards to the second, I'll be not a chacham for a moment only, because I can't answer much of the second question other than to say, they're not living in the desert necessarily, that they're doing that. But even so,
where they are.
What's that?
Israel or Babylonia.
Firstly, in the time of the Gemara, they're in the Galilee. In Eretz Yisrael, the Amorim, the center of Jewish life in the Galilee. It's not desert. And even Babel is not.
It's hot Middle Eastern climate.
Right, with that said, I don't really know. I can't explain, you know, why the reality of 12 months. But in terms of the first question, you're asking why they give a time limit. I think what they try to do in general, Chazal try, rather, in other words, the Mishnah gave a conceptual category, Yuvashim versus Lachim, or a generic description. But the Gemara is often interested in giving very specific guidance. So if you think about, for example, Ta'am, one is something Batel. So the Mishnah doesn't know of Shishim. The standard of Shishim and any number is not mentioned in the Mishnah. The only numbers that are mentioned in the Mishnah are things that have nothing to do with Tam, but which were Xeris Chachamim, the 100 for Truma to Bibatel, and the 200 for Arlen Kalan Karim, and those are Min Bimino. That's only when they're the same flavor, so it has nothing to do with taste. But everywhere else in the Mishnah, it's Hareze Beno Sein Tam. The Gemara comes along and says that they gave 60 because they took the most, except for very highly flavoring foods, they took Basar Belefes, and that would have been the strongest flavor, and even that is Batel B'Shishim. And that's why the Amorim are still fighting over what's a Shir Divin, less than Shishim, and so on. So I think their preference was to give things that gave people very clear guidance, and they probably gave on the upper end. In other words, you're right. In other words, I don't know if you could, you know, I don't know when they would typically dry out well enough, and in what context, but the assumption was by 12 months, in almost any climactic circumstances, it would be dry enough that you wouldn't have to worry about it. That was what I would assume.
Is it possible to answer Marshall's question by saying that the 12 months is a batal bahana? In other words, there's an economic loss that you're taking for that 12 months, that is upon you that negates any of the potential benefit from a pure, you know, right. monetary
so,
economic.
So benefit. I don't think that this was a fundamentally economic issue. In other words, Jews didn't need to buy Chartzan and Vizagim Shalov de Kochavim. I presume in the ancient, in the classical world, Jews were involved in producing their own wine. No, I can't imagine it was so, you know, so remote from that this was so important. It sounds like, again, they would have bought it because there would have been some benefit, but I doubt. It would also seem to me that how many Gentiles would keep it. In other words, unless people did this more commonly, who would have kept it around? In other words, firstly, you're not allowed to buy. Remember, you're not. I believe that you're not allowed to buy them before the 12 months from the non-Jew. And as if they fell into your possession, now as a mother also, you'd leave them alone. But to go buy them within 12 months is probably not permitted. It's only after the Gentiles had aged them for 12 months, then at that point we say, this is not a problem of the Yainesach.
It's possible that the 12 months is an agricultural cycle?
Yes, although I wouldn't...
Like Chadash?
No, just a cycle. In other words, till the next crop of grapes come.
But why? And then the question is why? Because they're interested. The Gemara is giving that as, remember, the Amoraim are giving that as the definition of Yavesh. Right? And as you can't, Marshall's point thing is a correct one. Fundamentally, you don't want to forget that the criteria is, are they dry or not? So it's hard to say 12 months would be an agricultural cycle, because why would they have given it? Why would they have cared? At this point, once it's detached from the ground, it's removed from the agricultural cycle. So I don't think so. So, Rabbeinu Tam's
the canisters there, the vessels, and some are left over. So they only use it in an annual cycle. You finish with it from the harvest of the previous year, and it's left over in your vessels. So, what do you do with it? How do you deal with it? Does it matame it?
I think it's a very clever suggestion, but I'm wondering whether it's correct in terms of the mitzias. If you think about, forget chartzanim and zag for a second. That's a more interesting case, because chartzanim and zag were typically left on the pressing floor, whatever it is, whatever the vessel they were pressed in. Presumably, they had them been cleaned out, and maybe they did something with you, right? But if you think about the shmarim of wine, so the shmarim of wine only really come into accessible once you finish drinking the wine, and presumably, 12 months is you would need those barrels within less than 12 months from the time that the shmarim is available. And let's say it takes a week, 2 weeks, a month, 2 months. To get to the shmarim of the wine, and now the drying process starts, they're going to need those barrels in less than 12 months. In other words, I just don't think in practice it would.
So let's take a jug that you put the wine in.
Right,
but there's residue left over at the bottom.
Yes, but
how do you use that jug again? You know, it's an economic thing to be able to use the jug.
Yeah, but no, agreed. But agriculturally, you're going to need it in less than 12 months for storage. Right. In other words, you're going to need it by the time the next time the grapes get pressed, and you haven't gotten to those shmarim until you've drank the wine, which means you don't have 12 months till the next pressing cycle. So that's why it's hard for me to believe that it's about the 12 months would ever work out practically for anyone. In other words, by saying 12 months, if you are right, you're basically saying never.
But 12 months is also 24 months.
You mean going a second cycle
in the jug and keep it for 2 years?
Yeah, I guess.
And so it ferments and
right.
And then you're finished in 2 years.
So you're right. You're right. But it assumes too much precision as to when you drank the wine. It's possible. I suspect 12 months is just a figure which they assume to be enough time. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd faster say that the value of 12 months is it guarantees a hot season went by. That would be, I think, a better, you know, maybe a way of sort of approaching it, right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Makes sense.
And then it doesn't matter when you get to the dregs, when you know when they become available, when the wine is emptied. 12 months at that point, you're guaranteed that a summer has passed over. Okay, fine. So Rabbeinu Tam says on the second to last line, he says they're not batel kevan de lataim avid kedamridan. The Gemara in Chulin actually says hanach l'saor v'tavlin de lataim avid v'lo batle. In other words, spices, normally the rule is shishim is the standard for bittul, because most things you won't be able to taste with 60. But the Gemara says, seor and tavlin, which is yeast, and tavlin are spices, are not batel. I mean, they are both batel, but normally they're not batel because they're made to have an impact, to have flavor. So if you take salt, I don't know if salt is the strongest of flavors. I mean, certainly has flavor. If you had salt that was really usser, you know, let's say, as I think I gave the example, someone bowed down to a salt tablet. Okay, they made it their god. They bowed down to it. So the box of salt tablets. Otherwise, it's hard to get salt that's usser bachila or bahana. If you get it because the salt absorbed blood, the salt isn't usser. It's just to the extent that part of it is blood, that's usser. But the salt isn't. So I want salt that's really usser. So if I have this, I worship my salt sculpture, and now it's usser bahana, and now I'm done with it. So I start chipping off pieces and I make toss it into the stew. If you have less than 1/60th, but you can still taste the salt, it's usser, right? Because that the salt is avi l'taim, and certainly other spices as well. And sa'or, as we explained, leaves an impact as well. I suspect, by the way, that if you hold that the concept of tam ke'ikar is d'oraisa, if you can taste the salt, that is d'oraisa. It is also midoraisa to eat it, whereas the sa'or is only going to be midrabanan, because you're not going to really taste physically the sa'or, you're just going to see the impact of the sa'or. Now, the last line in Tosfos is really fascinating. That's so fascinating, I don't know what to do with it. I interrupted my wife. She was sitting with some people Shabbos yesterday afternoon. I said, can you explain to me this line in Tosfos? Because she's the historian in the family. So I figured maybe she knows something, I don't know. Because of Rabbeinu Tam, and he's talking about Rabbeinu Ephraim. V'hamore yore kivensore umore, v'ala ye'ore ruach habore. He says, and the one who paskins like a ben sora umore, but upon me the spirit of the creator has been emptied. And it's like a poetic line attacking Rabbeinu Ephraim. It's kind of funny. You know, contemporary rabbis and their debates and their sharp language have nothing over the Rishonim. So anyway, I'm kind of wondering, I know that Rabbeinu Tam didn't like Rabbeinu Meshulam. I think we saw that recently. I forget what the case was. I'm sorry, it wasn't in the shir, it was in a different shir. Rabbeinu Tam, there are many places Rabbeinu Tam attacks Rabbeinu Meshulam. In fact, the only time you see Rabbeinu Meshulam was from Provence. He wasn't really an Ashkenazi, and I think that was part of the issue. He had these funny practices. So anytime you see Rabbeinu Meshulam quoted in Tosfos and Shas, it's Rabbeinu Tam attacking him. It's, you know, something, he's wrong about this, he's wrong about that. So I don't know, Rabbeinu Ephraim was one of the Balei Tosfos, not one of the more common Balei Tosfos. I don't know what the story is, why exactly Rabbeinu Tam really, this is very harif. You know, I usually, you know, call my children on occasion when they're misbehaving ben sora mora, but calling a rabbinic colleague that's a little overboard.
Where is Rabbeinu Ephraim from?
Regensburg. I assume that's Germany, I think, or something like that. It's northern France, Germany. So I don't know. Rabbeinu Tam was not very pleased with this. Okay. And then he says, finally, in a very interesting raya, over Tosefta, Shimarim Sheyavshu Asurim Bahana. Now, what is that line doing there? At least that dried out are asur bana. So Tosfos doesn't explain, but that's proof for Rabbeinu Tam, right? Because the Mishnah says that shmarim sheyavshu are mutter, right? Or chartzan v'zagim sheyavshu are mutter. And the Gemara says durdaya after 12 months are mutter. Durdaya are shmarim. So how can Tosefta say that the shmarim are asur? So the answer for Rabbeinu Tam is obvious, because these are shmarim that you didn't make temet out of first. In order for the lees, for the dregs, to be permissible, first you have to make temet, you have to extract the wine with the water, then you dry them out. Now the interesting thing here is that this is not necessarily the only way of reading the Tosefta. There are a couple of different approaches that might be taken that are interested from methodological and from a halachic just a practical perspective. The Rambam does not seem to hold like Rabbeinu Tam. The Rambam seems to have held like Rabbeinu Ephraim. I mean, he doesn't know of either of them, but the Rambam does not institute any requirement of making temed out of shmarim or making temed out of chartzanim and zagim in order for it to be permissible hana. As the Rambam read the Gemara Kipshuto, not the way Rabbeinu Tam is reading it. The question is, what do you do with the Tosefta? So there are really two possibilities here. It must have been the editor who did the Ritva, the Chidush Ritva. I think he writes in the footnotes, I don't know if it's his own, or he quotes someone suggesting that the Tosefta is Rabbi Meir's opinion. You know, don't forget, it was Machlokas in the Mishnah about Chartzanim and Zagim. Rabbi Meir said, Asurin v'isurin esrahana. He makes no distinction between dry and moist still. The Chachamim said that Lachim are Asurim and Yaveshim are Mutarim. So it could be the Tosefta is just Rabbi Meir's opinion. I would make a second, more perhaps a more methodological observation, which is that this is a general question: what exactly is our Tosefta? In other words, the Gemara speaks about a Tosefta of Rav Chiya and Rav Oshia, who were Talmidim of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, were responsible for the Tosefta. And the Gemara has an expression that Kol Mas Nisa Delotana Be Rav Chiya Rav Oshia, any Braisa not taught in the house, in the school of Rav Chiya and Rav Oshia, who says that it may not be valid? We don't have to accept it. It might not be what we call a mitaretzta. It may not be straight. It might not be correct. It might be a mishabeshta. We can dismiss it. You're not bound by any braises outside of the things that were taught in the house of in the school of Chiya and Rav Oshia. So what is our Tosefta? Well, we don't really know what our Tosefta is. Our Tosefta is a collection of braises, presumably from the end of the Tannaitic period, but not necessarily what I'll call authorized. And we have certain passages in our Tosefta that clearly are in error. Absolute error. And we have passages in our Tosefta that the Gemara seems to ignore and not quote. And the approach of Rishonim typically will be that if the Gemara doesn't quote a particular Tosefta, the answer may be is the Gemara didn't have it or it didn't regard it as being valid. It regarded it as a Mishabeshta, and that's why the Gemara doesn't cite it. And it's not uncommon, by the way, to have the Talmud Bavli take our Tosefta, or we have in our Tosefta, I don't know whether they're taking it or not, and modify it, manipulate it, take it differently, take it very different than you would have read the Tosefta, because it's not essentially the Tosefta, in capital T, once upon a time, was an authoritative collection, but we don't have it. What we have are sort of these cast-offs, many of which are quoted in the Bavli in a normal fashion, but if they're not, the assumption the Rishonim often make is, well, obviously that Tosefta didn't exist then, or they knew about it and they rejected it. And if the Bavli didn't reject the authority of a particular Braisa, then we can just ignore that. So the answer may be is that you're right. It could be there's a Tosefta that says that Shemarim Sheyavshu are Asurim. That's nice. And that's against our Gemara. Now our Gemara says Durdaya Daramai, the Shemarim of non-Jews after 12 months of Mutter. The Mishnah doesn't say anything about it. The Mishnah talks about the Psoles of the grapes, what was left over, the Chartzan and the Zagim. The Shemarim is something different because the Shemarim at least sat in the Chartzan and the Zagim are better in the sense that they were never really sitting in wine. The wine was squeezed out of it and the wine went down into the pit that collects the wine. But the Shemarim sat soaking in wine for a long period of time. So one could have said the Mishnah would never have permitted that. Okay, that's fine. But the Amoraim said that Shemarim of wine is permissible after 12 months, after it's dried out. So it could just be they either didn't have this Tosefta, or they rejected the Tosefta. Not a problem. So that could be the answer, as opposed to, again, the less methodological answer is that the Tosefta is Shitas Rabbi Meir that we have in the Mishnah, like Shitas Rabbi Meir in the Mishnah parallel. It's not identical. Rabbi Meir's talking about Chartzanim and Zag, and we're talking about, and the Tosefta is talking about Shemarim. But presumably, just as the Gemara equates the two, right? The Gemara assumes that for the Chachamim, Chartzanim and Zag after 12 months, once they're dried out, is okay, and dried means after 12 months. And the same thing for the dregs and the lees. So similarly, Rabbi Meir, who says that Chartzanim and Zag are always asa, will also always say that Shmarim are also always Aser. That's not a problem. Okay. Fine. So now, the Gemara continues. At the end of the second to last line, Amar Rav Chaviva Bered the Rava, Hani Gulfei. Gulfei would appear to be that we see in jars. Hani gulfei basar treser yarchei shat ashari. If you have jars, meaning vessels that contain wine, you empty them out and you leave them for 12 months, all is good. So I guess sherry casks after 12 months should not be a problem either. It's interesting. If they've been left to be dried out, of course they probably don't. But in theory, that should be the case. If they dried out, and I imagine actually might work partially. That is, if it's had the chance to really completely dry, so it's not a problem. Amar Rav Chaviva, Hane Abata Detayai. Rashi says an abata is a wine flask made from a leather wine flask. Tayoi are, Rashi says, Hoche Drom. Usually Tayoi is used as a word for Arab. I assume it means, not merchants, but, travel. I'm not.
Caravan?
Yeah, I don't know. Why am I, what's that? I don't know. People were always, caravans. People were always traveling. So, Basar Trese Yarche Shah Tashari. After 12, what?
Itinerant merchants.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe I'm mixed. There's a better word I have in my mind, but I don't know what it is. Maybe I'm imagining it. What?
Transient.
They're all true. They're all true. Okay. So after 12 months, it is permitted. Sure. Same thing.
Bed loose.
Okay. I know that when I leave, as soon as I get into my car, it's going to hit. The word that I want is going to hit me. Okay. Or maybe there's. What's that? Okay. The question is what? So that's the way Rashi reads. Tosus, interestingly enough, there seem to be different interpretations. Now remember, how else you machshir kelim which had wine in them? See, this is kind of interesting, because nobody says, let's say you have a treif pot. Nobody says, at least we don't usually assume, if you have a treif pot, leave it for 12 months, and then it's fine. The reason for that is because the assumption here is that the blios are different because it's cold. It's not absorbed through heat, and therefore the way you can get this out, in other words, it's easier to extract it, and less is absorbed, and you can extract it by leaving it for 12 months. There is a very interesting, I don't remember what the basis is, but Reb Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva. It was intended for people. He's mekel for bali tshuva who were becoming kosher, and they had very, very expensive sets of china. And the question is, you know, what do you do? Because the china is treif, you can't kosher cheres. So Reb Moshe put together, and it was really only takanas hashavim for people in the tshuva, a series of kulas, a series of different shitos combined. Two of them I remember. One of them I think I mentioned before, which is fascinating. Is that there's a position, there's a Yushalmi that says that something that's only Asar Midrabanan, that gets absorbed in pottery, you can kasher it by doing Hagala, boiling water, three times. So the Bala Ether says anything that's only Asar Midrabanan you can do, and that means the following as well. If you have any vessel that you cook tray food in, but remember that after 24 hours, the flavor inside the vessel is no Saint Tom of Gum. And no Saint Tom of Gam, it damages the food you cook in it. And no Saint Tom of Gam is really mutter. And the only reason you're not allowed to cook in the pot is not because of the Tom, but because we're afraid if we let you cook in it after 24 hours, you'll come to, when it's what we call Eino Benyomo, you'll come to cook with it within 24 hours. So the Bala Ether said that basically if you wait 24 hours, you should be able to kasher all these things. The Rashba, however, disagreed and said this is only by things whose core root is only midrabanan. But if you're talking about something that started out as a Torah prohibition, but has now been reduced to rabbinic prohibition because it's been sitting in the walls of the kli and has now become pogum, so that he said the Yushalmi's leniency doesn't apply to. Reb Moshe says, though, he combines one, so we don't pass with the Bala Ether. The Shulchan Aruch, I think, rejects it. I think explicitly rejects it. But nonetheless, one of the coolest Reb Moshe said was to use the Bala Ether. And number two, I forget who he quoted, which one of the Achronim argued that after 12 months, it also worked, and so that was one. He may have had one or two other things, but that was one of the tzedadim that Reb Moshe used in order to be lenient in that situation, so as to not serve as an impediment to someone, doing tshuva. So anyway, so that's what the Gemara here says. Certainly, here the Gemara says it clearly by vessels that held wine, not necessarily vessels that you cooked in. Okay, then Amar of Acha Breder of Ika, Hani Purtsani Teramoi, Bosar Tresa Yarche Shata Shari. He says that Purtsani Teramoi, that's what we saw already. That's the Rashi says Psoles Shalanovim. That's the leftovers of the grapes. The Targum of Chartsanim is Purtsanin. Okay. Tosus, in fact, claims Tosus. It's one of the strangest things I've ever seen in a Tosus. You have a machlokas atanaim, what chartzanim and zagar, and it's which is which. It's a mach, and as I mentioned earlier, it's a Mishnah Nazir. And Tosfos says he thinks that one shita makes more sense than the other. Now, it's not that I don't think we could say on our own intellectually that one shita makes more sense than the other, but for Tosfos to sort of suggest that, yeah, that's more mistamer. But part of his discussion, he points out that the targum of mechartzan v'yadzag, I didn't check our unquest, but I assume Tosfos is correct on this, is mipurtzonin ad itzurin. Now, atzur, otzer, means to press. So Tosu says that the part that you're really pressing, I mean, you press the whole grape, but the parts that you're getting the juice out of is the inside, not the skin. And therefore, Tosu says it makes sense that the zag is the... was I getting it backwards? No, he says it the other way. That doesn't make sense. Tosas says that I guess the question is, which does the pulp go with? Does the pulp go with the seeds or the pulp go with the skin? So Tosas is assuming, definitely, that I said before, the pulp goes with the skin. And then just the little seeds on the, I guess, the truth is, the problem is I'm used to eating grapes without seeds in them. But I guess if you eat seeds, grapes, you have grapes with seeds, and then you take the seeds are one thing and everything else is the other. So Tosas says, Mechartzanim v'ad zag. The zag is the part that's eats through and the part that really gets pressed, that gets squeezed out the juice. And therefore, that must be the skin and the pulp, and the chartzanim are the seeds that are on the inside. Now, the more logical proof, which is what I think Tosus also mentions, is that the plural, there's only one, when you talk about a single grape, there are two entities there. There is the pulp slash skin, and there are the seeds. Only the seeds come in the plural. And therefore, that I think that is a better proof. Of course, the proof that's cited in the Mishnah is that when you have a bell with a ringer inside, so the zag, you have a zag and you have an inbal, and the inbal, as I think, is the bell on the inside, and the zag is the thing on the outside. So chartzanim biyad zag, the zag is the outside of the grape, and the chartzanim is like the inbal. Yeah. Okay.
At the Inbal Hotel, it's the bell jar, not the clapper.
Well, maybe they got it wrong. I don't know.
Maybe they didn't read Tosas.
Yes. Okay, so...
I don't hold by that.
So Tosas says the inbal is mekashkesh besocho. It's the clapper on the inside of the bell. Okay. What's that?
You should write to them.
First, I have to get the name changed of the Tinek Mikvah to the Tinek Mikveh, because they got it wrong, okay? You know, Lenny, if you know, I have to start changing the bulletin, okay? It's not the Mikvah, it's the Mikveh. Yes, it is Mikveh Mayim. If it were feminine, it would be Mikvas, okay? But it's Mikveh. I don't you know, don't change it on my account here. People will get very confused.
So after
that, we'll deal with the inbal. Okay. I'm more likely to have success in the Mikveh campaign than I am in the. And that's only after I fix.
Start showing a little hammer.
And that's only after I fix Mar Cheshvan first. So okay. Anyway, so then the last line in the Gemara is Amar of Acha Breid the Rava Hane Gufei Shchime VeUchmei Basar Treisa Sharcha Yarchei Shat Hashari. The Gufei, he's talking about pottery jars that held wine. Apparently the red ones Shchime VeUchmei, the black ones, after 12 months they're permitted because they dry out as well. Okay, so I think we'll stop here. This is the last of. This is the last we're going to hear of directly the wine. And we still have some things that they would mix wine into. And then hopefully next week we'll also get to start to talk about cheese.
Oh.
Okay.
Start. Rabbi Reeder, to tie up what we said from last week.
Yes.
Glycerin, in fact, is made by rendering fat. These days mostly animal fat. And then adding lye. It's basically, you know, it's the myth of the Nazis using Jewish fat to make soap. That was glycerin soap that they were alleged to make. That's how you make glycerin. Right, that it's, you know, in the traditional sense, it's
trafe. It's trafe, okay. Very good.